The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Hello and welcome to our podcast. I'm Jessica Brown, linguistic editor at Culturico, and we are in for a very special conversation. Today, we are talking about the Arut March. This is a nationwide march in Pakistan that has been carried out since 2018 on International Women's Day, March 8. It protests against the rampant abuse and patriarchal violence that women and other gender and class minorities are subjected to. The theme for this year's March of 2021 is women's health. And for that, the volunteers released a detailed manifesto outlining a blueprint for a feminist healthcare system that takes into account the needs of all marginalized bodies. It is my privilege to talk with two of the volunteers of the march in Lahore, Omena Aziz and Ajwa Nadeem. Ajwa is a student and Omena is an editor-in-chief at Culturico. Hello and welcome.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you for having us.
It's wonderful to have you. I'd like to hear if you can, if you guys want to tell me your life and you, how did you become engaged or involved with this march? Ajwa, do you want to start out?
Yep. So I kind of date back to 2018. The first Arut March happened in Lahore in 2018, and then I was just like participating in it. I had to come alone because there was no friend available, and by then it was just this small new thing happening that women were coming out on the streets and marching on the Global Women Day. It had happened in, like, it was also happening in Karachi at that time, which is also another main urban center of Pakistan. But like in 2019, as Arut March always does, they put out a public call for volunteers. They always make sure that it's like on social media as much as possible, shared around by people as much as possible to make sure that it's as democratic as possible. So I attended the volunteer meetings and they're very, very open to suggestions, asking for it because they want to make sure it's as much of a collective effort as possible and no hierarchy, which means that everyone's ideas are debated and considered. And honestly, the way it works is the more you are able to volunteer, the more burden stake you have in the things that are being made and just generally in what is happening. Yes. So I started volunteering a lot in 2019, and after the 2020 march, I think I was approached by some other people in the march, and they said that they wanted to make a core group even after the march, make sure that it's not a one type event kind of thing. Yes. And have as many people as possible to work all over the year. So that's how I became involved in that.
Oh, that's brilliant. What about you, Omena?
So I'm a relative newcomer. I was always very interested in the Arut March, and I was never really able to be a part of it. I have not lived in Pakistan for some time now, so I was never really able to get fully involved as I wanted to. But last year, I got the opportunity. I saw the call for volunteers, and I contacted them and said, what work can I do remotely? They said, you're more than welcome to do it. The pandemic, and as well as needing the volunteers to do some of the work, it didn't matter which time zone I was in, which country I was in. Yeah. So I was able to help out quite a bit. So from the call to volunteers last year, I joined in, and I have been a part since then, and I hope to be a part for many, many years to come.
Yes. Oh, I love hearing that. And I'm curious to hear, with your involvement, what was the people around you, families, friends, what did they think of your involvement? Was it empathetic or sympathetic support? Was there interest? Did you feel any antagonism or apathy?
So I'm around 23 years old. My family has no idea that I volunteer for Earth March because they wouldn't allow me to do that, in the sense that a lot of the volunteer requires me to go to different places. And even just like being involved with Earth March, speaking, like being in their meetings, et cetera, I think that there is a huge misconception about what Earth March is and what it needs and what it demands, because of which, like, they wouldn't be okay with it. And so, yeah, I have never told my family. My friends have been very encouraging about it. They always understand that when it's like near Earth March or whenever there's a protest such as the one we have tomorrow in solidarity with the Palestinian resistance, that means I'm going to be kind of unavailable for a while. So they have always been very accommodating and encouraging.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's interesting. You've got a full spectrum of needing to keep it quiet and then also getting the support and figuring out who you are, what your work is. I love hearing about that.
And like a lot of the volunteers of Earth March, especially young women, their families do not know that they are volunteering or are engaged with Earth March in any capacity, and they kind of have to do it undercover.
Yes. You know, this is something that might be interesting to think about when we start talking about the march and the manifesto. But this last year in 2021, there was quite a kind of campaign of misinformation around it. And I don't think that would help. I think that would be frustrating because you'd want to make sure that what you are doing and what you are advocating for was put in the best light, or at least in the honest light. And then when that doesn't happen, people's suspicions or fears are ignited all the more. Omena, what was it like? What has it been like for you with the people around you? And also, what was it like kind of on the virtual scene when there was so much misinformation going on?
I am very lucky because most of my family and friends' reaction was, wait, you weren't already volunteering? Yeah. They had expected me to be part of a movement like this for much, much, much earlier than I actually was. Yeah. But I did, of course, receive a lot of worried messages and calls just because of the same misinformation that spreads all year round everywhere. Yeah. There's a lot of backlash we face. And of course, there's a lot of concern from the family. There is some antagonism as well with people who genuinely don't believe in the message that Earth March is propagating. Yeah. And they try to fight back. And I argue with them. I have a lot of time. I can argue for a long period. So that doesn't bother me in the least. So it's been a mixed reaction, but mostly I've been lucky enough to have a lot of support and positivity around my involvement.
That's great. So I wanted to give the listeners a kind of grounded or some sensory details about the march this year before we kind of get into the ideas of the march and the manifesto. And Adjoa, I think you're the one for this. What was it like this year at the march? What city were you in and how did you experience it?
So I was in Lahore, and we always have the march in front of the press club, the Lahore Press Club. And usually what you see in Pakistan on any street are a few, like at most 2 to 3 women, and just generally there being a lot more men. So it's just a sensory overload when you see around 2,000 to 3,000 women coming out on the streets, even though like actually we were worried that this year very few women would be able to come because of the coronavirus pandemic. Yes. But and also like we understood obviously there was the health concern and extra too, but still like around 4,000 to 5,000 women showed up. And another thing so we marched from one point to the other one, and there we like have a performance there, have like a stage there where people give their speeches. This time we had a nurse, a doctor, a female doctor, then we have a transgender person, a different disabled person and someone from like minorities give a speech related to their health concerns. Then we also had like different art performances which reused our Punjabi myths and like Punjabi folklore and mythologies and like make feminist versions of it, which get a lot, like basically the purpose of it is to make people feel like to make people feel that emotion and passion and to realize that the fight they get tired of engaging in every day.
Yes.
This is why we are here for it. Like, this is where we get our energy from. And yes. This time, one thing very unique that we had was that as you entered like the end point, there were clothes hung on clotheslines. And it was called Dirty Laundry, like artwork or performance piece. And on one side, people sent it to us. Actually, we asked people to spray paint or paint like their age when they were first like harassed or abused, and the person who did it on the backs. And then we also made some ourselves. So we had like clothes written like 10 and then brother on the backside, or like 12 and then like Kari Saab on the backside. So like as soon as you entered, you had around like 100 clothes hung like that, which was again something that like it was just kind of hit in the face, but that's a very powerful moment. And some of the volunteers even started crying when it was finally set up, because like it was like literally every, because we are told to hide it in our houses. There were incest cases written over there too, something that no victim can ever say out loud, but we could during using those clothes. And we also always have a Me Too blanket, a very long red cloth on which people write their sexual harassment experiences and stories, and then we hang it on our back. So here in Pakistan, usually brides have to like go under a red cloth, and that's like part of the ceremony. So this was a version of that, our own red cloth, but showing the stories that we are told to hide and our traumas that we might only be able to unveil like this in Pakistan.
Oh, both of those things, the dirty laundry and the red blanket, are incredibly powerful to hear about. And their power would be on so many different levels of communicating what is hardly ever communicated and is really makes people afraid when you start to communicate them. But also, I think it would communicate for people to not feel so alone. When things like this are shared, I think people feel less kind of harrowingly alone.
Another thing I would like to add was that this time we introduced a new song. So we always do two performances, collective ones. One is the Urdu and version of The Rapist Is You, the Chilean feminist song, which points towards the judiciary, the government, and the systems that are responsible for it. And there's a part of the song where you say, no, the rapist is you, and everyone's just like chanting it together. Entire crowd is doing that together. Wow. And another thing was where we took an inspiration from the Pinjra Tor movement in India, where there was like an on-ground organizing in female hostels in India, where they on-ground organizing based on sexual harassment that was happening in the hostels. And the purpose of that movement was that we don't want more surveillance, more securitization. What we want is men and people generally to change their perspective. And we took their song Kuriye Mere Desh Diye, made a Punjabi version of it, and this was something new because we were introducing a song in our local language and just spreading it beforehand. And this wasn't even Urdu, this was like local Punjabi, which meant that even the policemen and women who were there to like keep a check on us and were generally a hindrance during the march, even like they had to admit that this was not an elitist kind of movement and that this was reaching out to more people. So we had that song and everyone joined in at the end.
Oh, this is very powerful. Thank you so much for telling us about these things. We can envision them. We can think about them as we're talking about the ideas. So I really appreciate that. And here you were, Omena, on the other side of the ocean. What were you doing? Were you watching it on social media? How were you kind of participating that day?
I was mostly feeling extremely sad about myself and feeling very proud, though. I have to be honest. I was watching it on social media and there were still some stuff that needs to be done while the other people are on the ground. For example, everyone who's taking the photos, those need to be watermarked to ensure. We have spoken about the misinformation a little bit before. I'm going to touch on it now. There are factions that tend to Photoshop or mislead the messages or alter them in some way. So for our own safety, some of the photos that we post online need to be watermarked to ensure that we have the originals and that we can prove if something comes up that this is not the message that we were promoting.
Yes.
So that was something I could be involved in. Great. And we also want to have a virtual, let's say, march happening side by side. Because of the pandemic, we were very cognizant of the fact that not everyone will be able to get out on the street as they might want to. So we were also kind of working with that, using the hashtags, being on Twitter, being on Instagram, supporting the march virtually, however we could. So that was something I was involved in. And thankfully, that made me feel closer to everyone on the ground.
Yes, I love hearing that. There would be, you know, I appreciate what you said. There was work to be done, making sure that the original, you know, intent and footage was being preserved, documented and preserved, but then also reaching out to people who maybe couldn't show up that year, whether because of COVID or because, I don't know, I'd say it's a courageous thing to show up. So maybe for those who aren't quite ready to see it in action would be so precious, would be very vital. So I want to know, I thank you so much to you both for setting the scene of the day and kind of the emotions going into it, and also what was happening on the ground, what was happening not on the ground, but across the ocean, but was still being 100% participating. Let's move into talking about the march and the manifesto. And one of the first things I kind of wanted to hear from you both, and you've spoken to this already a little bit, Anjua, but thinking about the scope of it and where you want it to land, both in women's lives and in politics, culturally. So in the sense that the march gives voice to women's rights, and I think even be understand as human rights, for the march, what are your hopes and aims regarding where it lands, what it moves, what it does? And this could be culturally, psychologically, also thinking about governance or policies.
This has several layers to it. The first and very important and core part of the march, even when it did not have the visibility it has this year, is women coming out on the streets and them being able to feel that collective energy, anger, and passion. Because all of the time, we are chanting slogans like "My body, my choice," which translates to "Mera jism, meri marzi" in Urdu, and it became quite a controversial one that was like used against the march a lot. And we kind of like work a lot to correct that narrative, where we would go to media shows and just like argue with them at length about how it does not only mean that like women want to be nude, even though like there's some problem with that. Like it doesn't only mean that, but it is touching all various aspects of like women's issues. But like overall, so just like coming out onto the streets and being able to march is something that like is a right that we want to be able to practice. The freedom of being able to practice that is something that every woman in Pakistan can feel empowered by, and that they feel less alone by. And it reignites that drive within you to keep on struggling. But because obviously women coming out on the streets in a country like Pakistan, honestly, in any other country, it's going to be met with resistance. And it's with dealing with that resistance that like our messaging and our purpose becomes more clear. So what I mean by that is like more than the government, because the things the Pakistani government does are kind of like in the backhand. So like we would have trouble while we're getting an NOC. Should we get a permit for the street or not? What are the other tactics they're using? So like they kind of try to remain in the background, even though they are like very like important hurdles for us too. But like generally the media narrative, because Aurat March is a narrative, like eventual aim is to kind of also change the narrative. Women have been like struggling and coming out on the streets long before the Earth March. So we have the Women Action Forum, which resisted against the draconian laws being introduced by President Zia, which reduced the legal testimony of women. So we had all of that struggle. Women have been doing that. Earth March is not unique in that. What it is unique in is its more primary focus on rights centered within the private sphere, within your house, which is not only talking about political, legal, or constitutional rights, but also linking them to the day-to-day experiences of harassment, about defamation charges that you might face if you talk about it on the online world and stuff like that.
Yes.
So what we do is we try to change that narrative, and also we kind of become important like for constitutional matters at Exeter too, because the year before this one, we had to like fight our right to come to march in court, and we won that. But other than that, I just think that because of the pressure group that Earth March has become, any kind of protest that we go to or statement that we release at Exeter, it becomes an important thing that like political leaders at Exeter have to at least respond to, if not take seriously.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay, thank you, Ajwa. And I'm just going to reflect back kind of what I heard there. It's getting out to the street, coming out into the open, having a presence, having a voice. And I appreciate what you said. Of course, it's so important to start to change policies, speak truth to politicians, try to get things changed at the large level. But then you're also doing cultural work where those deep, deep cultural structures are kind of pushed up against, questioned, giving a voice for that. Lots of levels. That's very exciting and very creative, powerful. Omeda, do you want to weigh in on any of that?
I do want to just add on to what Ajwa said. It is very important to note that while the government, as Ajwa noticed, it does put hurdles in our path, for example, by blocking our permits and things of that sort. She's absolutely right in noticing that it stays at the background. It doesn't actively work in a way that we can say, oh, this is all the government's fault. And that's why it's very important to note that, yes, we are struggling against the societal and familial norms of patriarchy that are embedded in our culture. That is the main problem that we are trying to highlight, and we are trying to emphasize that this is not just something that comes from, of course, patriarchy is embedded into the structures that surround us, but it is also embedded into our very psyches, into how we look at things, into how our families respond to girls being born.
Yes.
To their education, to their marriage, to their healthcare access, to how, as Ajwa again mentioned, how they even go out in public.
Yes.
So I don't want to talk for everyone, but this is something that really attracts me about the Audit March, that it is working on the ground level. It's working from the bottom up to change things on these levels, because without the internalized misogyny that we carry with us being targeted, we can't really go anywhere. We can't get anywhere.
Oh, that's brilliant. I want to, I'm going to segue that right into the next question, which looks at the manifesto. And this year's manifesto is Our Health Matters, a feminist manifesto on healthcare. And for those listening, it's an incredible 35-page document. It's thorough, vital, well-researched, and I would add moving, with sections on physical health, reproductive health, mental health, environmental health, gender bias in medical research, and on the inequitable care burden. It covers such things as the need for universal health care, how individuals can avail of health care outside of a typical family unit. It advocates for survivors of abuse to access mental as well as physical care. It calls for educational program and gender bias training in medical professionals. It advocates for the rights of differently abled people, the conditions of female prisoners, how addiction and usage of drugs is to be treated as a public health issue rather than through a punitive approach. It demands an immediate end to early age under marriage, raising the minimum age of consent for girls from 16 to 18, advocates that humane and non-exploitative working conditions should be recognized as a public health issue, It advocates for access to birth control and recognizes that willful denial of contraception or access to health services is a form of domestic violence. It tackles issues attached with menstrual health, with access to knowledge, products, and latrines. It asserts that emotional and psychological abuse be recognized as a form of violence. It demands trauma training of legal professionals for more informed responses to cases of abuse, sexual assault, and harassment. It addresses the need to eliminate chemical pollutants to protect maternal health and the health of future generations, and demands that to take measures to improve sanitation conditions and access to water. It calls for an end to male bias in physiology, pharmacology, and neuroscience. This among many others. Frankly, as I said, this document is a profound statement of reimagining healthcare on multiple levels and from different angles. It's empowering and caring. Omena and Ajwa, how did you guys decide on this year's theme?
I feel like because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the crisis was world over. This really caused us to take a deep and hard look at the other pandemic that women all over the world are facing, which is, as you've mentioned, there's a lack of access to adequate healthcare. There's already domestic violence. There's all kinds of abuse that they're facing. Women have always been facing a pandemic of violence and of extreme this violence against their health. Mm-hmm. So COVID-19 just brought all of these things to the surface more and more. We saw how many women had to lose their jobs. We saw how many women came out of the workforce, how much the burden of care increased on them while they were working and taking care of all the household tasks. When we started digging into this a little bit deeper, it became clear that we, not only in Pakistan, but more than likely the world over, do need a very specific, more feminist version of healthcare, because feminism is not just for women. I challenge anyone who says that. I really do. I do not believe in this.
Yes.
But it is for all oppressed minorities, sexual and gender minorities.
Yes.
And so that is why we made a special effort to focus the manifesto on health and healthcare and who it is provided by and who it is provided to.
Yes. What did the process of writing this manifesto look like? I mean, it's a dense, like I said, dense, well-researched, thorough document. Was there many authors, and how did the drafting go? How did you decide what went in and what stayed out?
So I would need Mena to answer that, because I think she did far much more for it than I did. But before that, adding to the previous two things to the previous question.
Yes.
Another main reason why we wanted to focus on health as our theme is, we have had themes in the previous 2 years too, but this time, because this isn't we called it the pandemic of patriarchy purposefully, and it wasn't meant to trivialize how the coronavirus pandemic has halted and corroded our lives and forced governments to make changes that they would frankly say a year ago weren't possible for them at extra, right? But they did that. And this kind of we wanted that kind of framing for women's issues too, because women in Pakistan, they were facing so much harm, facing harm that you couldn't in any good consciousness say was lesser than the coronavirus pandemic, et cetera. They health related harms and how issues that we wouldn't normally conceptualize as health related, such as research bias or such as education or even mental health, et cetera, they aren't considered as women's health issues or something that needs to be prioritized in a Pakistan where a lot of them don't even have access to safe water. But we wanted to make a comprehensive document that didn't prioritize one issue above the other, but made sure that people look at it in a very intersectional manner, realizing each of these things are connected with each other.
Yes.
And this isn't something new, right? This is something that people have also commented regarding 9/11, where they say that if the American state could respond so proactively to 9/11, there are a lot of problems with their response too. But if they could do that, they should, we had the more people die in, more women die in USA because of gender-related crimes than people died in the 9/11 tragedy. And just generally how all over the world there is this harm that female bodies are bearing, but it is ignored because of how it's normalized it has become. And this was a unique opportunity for us to kind of like co-opt the urgency of the pandemic onto a problem that has existed for far too long.
Yes, thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. You can articulate this so much better than I can. So about writing the manifesto, this was definitely a collective effort. This was a massive collective effort on the part of all the volunteers of Aurat March. We did have meetings where we would decide on which topics we would cover, who would take up which particular topic, which particular section. Okay. The research was done by those volunteers and then written down. And then the editing was also another collective effort where the document was shared between all of the authors and we would be working on it simultaneously sometimes, which was really funny because of the different time zones and somebody working on one section and another person working on another section. And
yeah, we had a joke going along that doc syncing is like Google Doc syncing is one of the most intimate experiences that you can share.
I love that. You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking of a thought comes to mind. Ursula Le Guin talks about the carrier bag theory of fiction. And, you know, so much of fiction is violent, you know, about the sword, what wins with the sword. And she presents this idea of what about making bags? You know, we've had to figure out how to carry water. We've had to figure out how to carry grain. And usually it's collective, it's collaborative work to weave a basket and to carry. It's usually women's work. And right when you were talking about doc sync, you know, document syncing and working on it at the same time, this image comes across as a collective building something, making something, weaving it together.
A tapestry weaving.
Yes, it's beautiful and very exciting. It's definitely not a zero-sum game. I think this is what we're hopefully learning in the West. We can't, that model is so desperately broken. The more voices that you can be involved in making, it works better. And it's
absolutely
it's more flourishing.
Because
yeah.
I do want to add to this that the reason why having this collective effort helped was because the work could get researched and have multiple pairs of eyes on it.
Yes.
So the facts could be checked and double checked and triple checked. And then also this ensured that we were as for example, abled people were not the only ones who were writing this document.
Right, right.
We had people who were differently abled who took a look at these different sections and made sure that what we were writing was in tune with what they wanted.
Yes.
It wasn't just policies that we had seen online and said, okay, you know what, this works.
Yeah.
No, we actually got the feedback from people who the policies would affect and asked them to make sure that these are the policies that they would like to see in place.
Oh,
so a collective effort
good.
In more than one ways, then it elevates the voices of people who might not be getting that elevation in maybe another platform. This is just another way for them to have their voices and their concerns be at the forefront.
I love that. And that goes right into my next question, something I was curious about, very interested about. Anytime in thinking about the march and the manifesto, there's obviously going to be questions about intersectionality that arise. And I was hearing about this collaborative take on the manifesto, this collaborative work on the manifesto. So, and then thinking about the march, and Ajwa, I bet you'd have something to add to this because you were on the ground getting people to actually come to the march. And I'm wondering, how has it been involving and giving voice to different sectors? And I'm thinking about people across different socioeconomic groups, generational. I'm particularly interested in those who are older. You know, would they feel this is for them? Is it difficult? Is it easy for them to see themselves as involved or represented? And then perhaps tied with that and perhaps not, what has it been? I'm kind of thinking about people who want better representation and better healthcare and are interested in what you guys are doing and talking about, what the march is doing and talking about, but might feel on the fringes or might be uncomfortable with the language or might identify as more traditional or more traditionally religious. Is it important to, has it been important to you to figure out how to include those voices and how has that gone?
Yeah, so like I will jump to the last question. immediately. So like a lot of people is a general misconception about the participants of the march, especially yes. because a lot of the resistance that we're getting is from the right wing, which has traditionally been religious, yes. is that like they are not that close to their religion. Yeah. Most of the marchers, they belong to some kind of religion or at least feel some sort of closeness to it. And so in a place like Pakistan, where you have like 6,000 women coming out on the streets, a yes. lot of the volunteers are Muslim at extra too. But then like people who use religion in order to delegitimize the march, we have to look at them like with a bit of nuance. So yes. usually like as Aurat march in a place like Pakistan, you can't rebut them with religion. There are vast interpretations of Quran available, or of like because usually Islam is used against us in Pakistan since it's like an Islamic Republic of Pakistan, right? We cannot rebut them using like different interpretations, because that's dangerous, blasphemous ground that can be used against us, especially because we're under such a huge limelight, right? So that's why like we try to deal with it in very like subtle ways, through subtle messaging. One of the ways that we dealt with it was through our collective history series of infographics, which were which is something we collectively decided together, which debunked the myth of like only apparently westernized pants and t-shirt wearing women coming out onto the streets. And it yes. talked about how the partition of 1947 involved a lot of women Muslim women in wheels coming out on the street performing daring acts, such as like putting up the Pakistani flag in on a dome and stuff like that. So there was about how we try to link the present march as much as possible with the shared history that can That's help great. People figure out how it's like more like how it doesn't fall into one particular religious like inclinations. But other than that, just like generally about the different groups in mind. Groups and minorities. So like so I think this is something that we're also very careful, very like conscious of when drafting the manifesto. Yes. It's like how the manifesto is a response to this very like huge NGOization of health within Pakistan. Well, women's health especially. And it was a response, it was basically a desire and a decision to make people look at women's health with a political lens too, and realizing how different things such as the HIV AIDS issue being different labeled, all of those are political issues that cannot only be solved by the development sector or by right. NGOs coming in and coming in and helping with that. And one right. very good example of on-ground example of that I can give is when one thing we did in this march is that we went to a semi-urban, like it's on like the outside of Lahore area, yes. urban Spura, where brick and workers, like went to them and we took part of the march there, where we like generally like had a sort of a celebration with them. Before that, we had set up a relationship with them, talking nice. To them like about talking to them about the manifesto, about the demands, and just and stuff like that. So and we talked with them about the health issues that they had faced, and they were and so like for a bit to contextualize what life for women, brick and worker women looks like in Pakistan. Yes. They are immigrants who like literally live in a small section, like a small sort of isolated area. And even the people of the neighborhood, they aren't that willing to interact with them. They told us they had a problem with even getting safe, clean water from there because people are just generally very like, there's a lot of stigma attached to them. And their entire life is under the brick and owner's hand. They do not get adequate pay, they do not get and there's no way that they can challenge them, they do not get yeah. clean water, and even that demand needs to be made to the owner who obviously has the power in his hand. And in this situation, if an NGO comes and gives you and sets up a pump of clean water, that's great and amazing, but that doesn't solve the core reason for why those health issues exist. Like the amount of work that is demanded from them, no matter what their health condition might be, it deteriorates yeah. the health on such a permanent basis. And this is why like health issues are a political issue that need to be worked and that yes. have something direct to do with like the power imbalance. So like that's one of the ways that we also like went and engaged with different communities, not only like not only asking for their opinions, but like also like inviting them to the march and like even bringing it there. And it was really heartening to see how we used art as a way to bridge the gap that we had. So like a lot of the volunteers weren't from that, like couldn't speak Punjabi that well at extra, but we had the performance, and this is like where other groups collaborate with us. So an activist theater group, it performed it performed Sassi Pannu, like a version of that for them, and it made the woman in the audience cry, and it made them like, and after that they opened us up to us with their own songs, like their own traditional songs, something the men in that area told us that they hadn't been able to make them do in like their joint meetings ever. So like that, and we seek to like maintain these relationships with them to help as much as possible, like with organizing them, with arranging protests for them. Like that's a long-term aim, but this was one of the ways we like kind of started with doing that.
That's incredible. It's so proactive what you did to kind of cross over. I like what you, I mean, literally you took the march to them, you chatted with them. So this is on the ground, kind of on the ground changing and community sharing, you know, coming together. It's also the big ideas when you, the first answer you gave, you know, speaking to connect people historically with the story of women being involved, so it doesn't feel so out of the blue or strange or alien, to try to look at it with nuance. I mean, these are, and then using art. I mean, this is an incredible, proactive, creative, nuanced response. And I think that's some of the only way that kind of intersectionality work is going to get done. Omena, any thoughts here?
I think Ajwa's covered everything so beautifully.
I know,
it's been
incredible.
Done so well.
I'm just blown away. It's such a nuanced, powerful answer. I'm
sitting here just like nodding my head going like, yes, she is correct. She is absolutely right.
It's incredible to hear such a powerful answer. I think anyone who's been trying to give voice to women's rights, to human rights, the intersectionality is a tough one. And I think both of you are bringing really creative answers. I mean, this is this model, this march, this manifesto, and how it got played out on March 8. I think this is something for the whole world to be learning from. So I'm going to, speaking of the whole world, I wanted to put what has been going on with the Arat March into its kind of international context. And thinking about human rights, our understanding of human rights and the way we have developed them in the last half century plus, I think is starting to be informed by, ever more informed by our existential understanding of the human experience. And to me, one part of that is having a voice and even reverse engineering it when the capacity to express voice is oppressed, something very integral to being human is shut down. And I mean, every word you've said, every word that both of you have said, I think speaks to this question. But how do you see the Arat March doing that? And do you think that's, do you think I'm on to something here talking about giving people a voice?
I would say yes. I think this is a very integral part of, and an integral, let's say, core mission of the Arat March, giving a voice. I don't like to use the word voiceless because nobody is voiceless. People are merely platformless, or maybe they're not getting enough exposure, or maybe they're, or they have a platform and it's just not being heard loudly enough or widely enough.
Yes.
So I do feel, just on a personal level as well, that it is our moral and ethical responsibility. It is a duty that as human beings who have some kind of privilege, who have some kind of platform, who have some kind of an audience, to make sure that these voices are elevated. I do look around and I see if we look at the different international situations that are playing out right now,
yes,
most of these are a direct result of not asking the people who are affected by policies, who are affected by actions that are taken by others.
Yeah.
The original people have not been asked their opinions. They have not been asked how they are going to be affected. They have not been asked how these are going to directly impact their lives and what other solutions they could possibly come up with.
Yeah.
This I feel is one of the biggest issues that we have faced. And as a former colonial nation, the subcontinent of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, I feel like we really relate strongly to this, that not having a voice in how we are governed, in how the laws have been passed that affect our lives,
yes,
that impacts generations to come. That impacts our history, that impacts our personal lives, that impacts everything. So it is really an imperative, a moral imperative on all of us to elevate these voices, to elevate the voices of the people, which might not be heard for one reason or the other, if we can do it.
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, completely echoing Omena when she says that, like, no one's voiceless as such. What yes. Earth March is about is creating a collective platform for that voice, because fighting alone can be hard,
yes,
lonely, and make you feel hopeless. What you get to do on the march, like, is not only to feel that collectiveness virtually, but to feel it with all of our bodies, with all of our senses, to be able
yes.
to share in that space, feel like your anger,
yeah,
your anger at all the injustice, it is valid, and not only valid, but being echoed by the other folks there too. So it's about, like, creating a collective voice that can, like, even make those individual voices stronger, give you more an agency and more of a desire and desire and just generally the energy to be able to fight those battles individually in your home too.
That's beautiful. I like what a lovely inflection to this idea of voice. It's not just giving a platform to an individual's voice, but making it so that that voice can be upheld by others, with others, alongside others. And I think that's really putting on the finger on the pulse of what we're looking for.
Yeah, because I think, like, within this neoliberal and
yes.
very individualistic way of
yes.
looking at the world, we imagine the voice as individual, but even
yeah.
that individual voice is never only arising out of the hurt that you have felt individually. Any
yes.
of that hurt is collective pain and collective indignation and anger that you want to voice. Like an Earth March, like many other movements within Pakistan, it just makes it makes sure that voice is amplified as much as possible.
That's an incredible statement from you both, an incredible input into this idea of the human voice, and really situating it. To be human is to be human with others. And I think that's so apparent in the work that you've been doing. I'm kind of overcome by such incredible, proactive, creative, and caring answers. So we're coming to the close of the podcast, to the interview, and I'd like to do that. I'd like to circle back to your narrative. What was your favorite? Did you have a favorite moment on March 8? I'd love to hear about it.
Heck yeah. Oh, so my favorite moment was when we had, like, one of the singers volunteer to sing Kuriye Mere Desh Diye, that song inspired by the Pindra Tod movement in India.
Yes.
So, because, like, the lyrics of that song, like, are really strong. They go somewhat, like, they roughly translate to Kuriye Mere Desh Diye, like, they roughly translate to how we are not okay with how if we have any problem, like, talwar utha le tu, like, hold up a sword, hold up a sword. It's very, like, kind of proactive in the sense how it's pushing women to, like, just stand up and resist it, and there are also, like, little things in it about how like women do as much work as men, but then why are they getting the lesser piece of the beat or practice within South Asia a lot, and all of these, like, it's a bit hard to translate its meaning in English. In Punjabi, it's like, it's a very strong and emotionally full and charged song. And so being able to sing the song we had been preparing and like preparing spread and it spread all over social media and having the entire crowd sing it with you, raise their fist whenever that part would come about, like, you know, holding up the sword. And that was a magical moment that I think every marcher felt that, because a lot of them talked about this song, particularly afterwards. They reshared our video of it a lot too. So that moment was very, like, it's a bit hard to describe it, but it energized me, I think.
Yes.
Charging me up for the entire next year of
yes.
having to whatever.
That is what you're going to be
this
carrying.
This is the full potential.
Yes.
Yeah. Like,
yes.
This is why I care. This is what we can be, and this is what we deserve to be. And anyone who dares to stop us is going to meet our full wrath. So, like,
yes.
This was, like, basically about that.
Oh, thank you. I love your sharing of that. You're very generous to share it with us. Omena, what about you? What was your favorite moment that day?
I think I can't pinpoint to one moment in particular, but there were a couple of things that really, really stood out to me, and I loved it.
Oh.
I loved when people read our manifesto and the Charter of Demands, and
yes.
it cleared up a lot of the misconceptions they had about the march. I really, really liked it when women reached out to me who I had sent it to, and I said, you know, if you have any questions, let me know. And they came back to me and they said, you know what? We did not have the right idea about what it is that you guys actually work for, what you propagate in the march. That was a really
yeah.
lovely moment.
Yes.
And then when all the different women who marched and the volunteers, they reported this feeling of solidarity and joy and sisterhood by being around so many women in a space that's not normally available to them. That
yes.
really filled my heart with joy. That was really a wonderful moment to hear about all of their experiences and how full their hearts were as well.
Yes. Oh, thank you for sharing that. So before we sign off, I'd like to ask, is there anything else you'd like to say, either of you or both of you, that you'd like the listeners to know?
Yeah. So one of the important things we are doing after the march done and the way we are trying to deal with the backlash is the statement against big tech that we're circulating everywhere. Like, we have circulated it amongst Yale students through their society, have circulated it within our network, other social movements, Dextra's network. So basically after the backlash, because after the march, the videos were some of our videos were doctored, and like some of our slogans at Extra were misinterpreted to paint Aurat March as anti-religious and something that can be particularly dangerous within Pakistan's context, because here on a daily basis you have people use blasphemy allegations to instigate mob violence and imprison you at Extra. So
yes.
I think another result of just generally this kind of label being attached to Aurat March was that, like, some people who were recorded, interviewed by the media, and like our media also, like, who doesn't follow a lot of guidelines, especially YouTuber accounts, and they can purposefully ask provocative questions. So one of the, like, we had several women who got interviewed. Like, there was when other people got to know about it, and their families got to know about it, because most of them are coming undercover. So when they families got to know about it, it even posed like a security threat to them, where like their extended family, like we had someone, because extended family started threatening them, and just generally like very provocative questions and horrible videos being circulated. So one of the things that we do is we try to have it reported, and we were even working closely with the Facebook team of like Pakistan, but there are some things that they generally say we cannot take down. So if like a page is uploading a YouTube video and that page doesn't like own the video in itself, according to community's guidelines, like that particular, it couldn't be removed. And just generally, like, we even made a list of all the YouTube content against us and like the timestamps of where like that was happening, and gave that list to. And we have even made this like blacklist of all the YouTube accounts. This is the most that we can do as like a social movement. But then the responsibility falls on the big tech, because if it is apparently a bastion of free speech, and I think the problem of algorithm bias is becoming very obvious nowadays when we see
yes.
how the Palestinian resistance is like a shadow banned and so many other things by the different social media apps. Just like that, this statement the statement demands, like, for example, having more content moderators in Pakistan and paying them more, yes, because they have to see horrendous content and on a daily basis. And you are even like, you are giving them minimum wage to have like more human moderators, because your AI is always going to be biased. It's not going to understand the context of the global South, what those comments mean within that context, because which it's going to judge their like danger level differently. And just like, because like this is literally like them giving the situation of no alternative, right? Because we can't go off social media, which means that the urgency of this statement and the urgency of calling out big tech is that much greater, because we don't have viable alternatives that are going to be safer. So we have to try our hardest to build as much pressure to make them accountable. So yeah, that's one of the things we are doing. And if anyone wants to sign for that, they can go to our social media handles and we have this statement over there. So if the listeners want to do that, they can do that.
It's really important work there. Thank you. Omena?
I would obviously second what Ajwa has said, because this is very important. The big social media platforms accountable, yeah, and asking for radical transparency on how they deal with these accounts that are reported, on these posts that are reported, which ones they take down, why do they take them down? Do they have people who speak the language, who understand the cultural norms? Because if we are being sworn at and given death threats in Urdu, which is written in English, I don't know how many people that Facebook has employed are going to be able to read that and understand it. Yeah. So we really do need radical transparency. But on a more personal note, I would want to ask the listeners to listen to women, to believe them. If you can't believe women at their word when they are talking about their personal lived experiences, please educate yourself. Please read up. There is a ton of literature and research and statistics and studies available. It is all on our fingertips now. Please, please do not use this excuse that I have never seen this happen, so it does not happen. When people tell you about their lived experiences, if you cannot believe them at face value, please do the research. Please put in the effort to educate yourself and raise awareness within yourself and your circle about these problems, because we all have to begin at home. We have to begin at an individual level. So please,
thank you.
Once we do this, then we can have a level where parents will raise their kids with these lessons in mind.
Yes.
Bosses
yes.
will treat their employees with their lessons in mind. And scientists will design trials for drugs and medicines with these lessons in mind.
Oh, thank you. I've loved what you have said. Omena and Ajwa, thank you so very much for this conversation. It's been my absolute privilege to hear your story, your stories, your passion, the work you've been doing on the ground and in the big narratives. Thank you both so very much. I don't know where I'll be, how I'll be participating in Women's International Day next March 8, but I will be following the Arat March and I will be thinking of you both. I know the work that you're putting in of courage and changing the narrative. It is being harvested, and there's bigger harvest tomorrow and down the way. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us here and for being such an amazing host.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. It was lovely discussing this
with
you.
It was so good. Yeah. Very best to you, and please take care.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Culturico was produced by Jessica Brown. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at culturico.com. To get our latest episodes, subscribe to Culturico on your podcast platform of choice. If you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. It means the world to us. Thank you, and until next time.